Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural. And this week, instead of a guest, I decided to do a back in time, hot tub time moment about 100 years ago, an interesting story. The reason why I did it is that sometimes we get caught up with current events thinking it's never been as bad as this. Corruption, under the table dealings. We all think it's just a modern problem. And the following story proves that not quite. And the title of this piece is called Good Time Joe and the Great White Way. Now it starts off with a judge named Joseph Force Crater. He's a New York State Supreme Court justice, and one day he disappeared. This was in August of 1930, and still, almost 100 years later, there are no definite answers as to what happened to him. Lots of theories, but no answers. Judge Crater was remembered for several reasons. He was a philanderer of the First Order. He had a scrawny neck, only 14 inches, a head that was too small for his 6-foot body, and taking a taxi ride into oblivion. His disappearance stumped police, psychics, and armchair investigators long before Jimmy Hoffa evaporated from this earth in 1975. There was nothing in Crater's history to indicate he would become so notorious. He was born on January 5th, 1889 in Pennsylvania to Layla Virginia Nee Montague and Frank Ellsworth Crater. He was the oldest of four children. His father was prosperous. He owned an orchard and he was a produce market operator. Crater worked at his father's business when he was a teenager and went on to graduate from Columbia in 1916 with a law degree. He belonged to Sigma Chi and was a Mason like all the men in his family. He worked as a law clerk in New York City and taught legal classes at City College of New York, Fordham University, and New York University. That same year, he met Stella Mance Wheeler, a married woman. She'd married Edward Randolph Hampton, a printer, on May 27, 1908. Crater was instrumental in securing a divorce for her. They married within days after her divorce was finalized in March of 1917. A few years later, Joe Crater decided he would get into politics. He was appointed in 1920 as a secretary to New York Supreme Court Justice Robert F. Wagner Sr. In 1922, he suffered a personal loss when his younger brother, Douglas Montague Crater, died in an automobile accident in New Jersey. He was 29 years old. But Crater didn't lose sight of his goal, and in 1927, he set up his law practice. Now, the Craters could afford to entertain in a lavish style in their Fifth Avenue apartment. They hired a cook, a maid, and a chauffeur, which was the norm for the crowd they ran with, at least on a social level. Since Crater worked in the legal system, he was unaffected by the Wall Street crash in 1929. In April 1930, he was appointed by Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt to fill in for a Supreme Court judge who had resigned. By then, he was part of the New York Democratic organization known as Tammany Hall and the Cayuga County Democratic Club. During the summer, the courts were recessed, and the couple went to their cabin in Belgrade Lakes, Maine,
which they had owned for 15 years. In late July, the judge returned to the city. He told their maid, Almeida Christian, to return on August 25th, since this is when they would be returning to New York. After this, he traveled to Atlantic City with his showgirl girlfriend, Sally Lou Ritz. He returned to Maine on August 1st. 2 days later, he returned to New York City, promising his wife he would be back by her birthday, which was August 9th. According to Stella Crater, he received a phone call that upset him. She did not witness the call, since they didn't have a phone in the cabin, and he walked into town to use a phone. His wife said he didn't say who called, but he left the next day telling her he had to straighten those fellows out. On August 4th, accompanied by William Klein, an attorney who represented theater folk, they went to the Morosco Theater to see the show Ladies All. The next stop was Club Alley on West 54th Street, which was known to be a rendezvous of corrupt politicians and underworld potentates, then very intimately associated in New York. Gangster Oney Madden owned the club, and mobsters like Legs Diamond, Dutch Schultz, and Mad Dog Call were frequently seen there. The draw for Joe Crater was no doubt Elaine Dawn, another of his mistresses who was performing there. By 1931, Club Alley had closed after Chink Sherman and Dutch Schultz were shot in the place. On August 5th, Crater attended a bridge party at Dr. August Raggi's house. He also had a doctor look at a finger he smashed with a car door. The doctor was a friend and not his regular physician. On August 6th, he went to his office at the courthouse and went through his personal files. He destroyed some documents and put others in his briefcase. Next, he ordered his court attendant, Joseph Mara, to cash two checks that totaled $5,150. And then he took $20,000 from campaign funds. This would be equivalent to a year's salary for him. Then he left with two locked briefcases. Mara also helped him lug boxes of papers and a safe deposit box up to his apartment. Joseph was the son of John Mara, Tammany leader of the 23rd Assembly District. That evening, Crater was dressed to the nines in a brown pinstripe suit, gray spats, and a straw Panama hat. Earlier in the day, he purchased one ticket only to see a new show, Dancing Partner, that was playing at the Belasco Theater. He commented to the ticket clerk he planned to return to Maine the following day. Crater walked down the street to Billy Ha's Chop House at 332 West 45th Street. There he met Sally Lou Ritz and William Klein, who were eating dinner. In some versions, Sally's parents were present as well. He left at 9:15 p.m., having missed the 8:40 p.m. curtain for the show. He stepped into a tan-colored taxicab at New York Times Square and disappeared. Totally. The driver of the cab was never located despite the efforts of the detectives assigned to the case. The vehicle belonged to a well-known firm, but no record of the trip ever turned up in its files. The theater ticket he bought to the Belasco was never used, even though it was picked up. Now, who did that also is unknown. Later on, the story about where the judge went after leaving the restaurant varied. In one version, he got in the taxi. In another, he walked away while his companions were the ones that took the cab. August 9th came and went, and the judge failed to return to Maine. A week later, Stella Crater sent her chauffeur, Fred Collar, to New York to locate her husband. He sent back a vague telegram. Possibly, he was assured by Crater's colleagues who were trying to cover for him in case he was spending time with a showgirl and had lost track of time. On August 25th, the courts were back in session and Judge Crater was a no-show. On August 29, when Stella got a call from one of his friends asking where he was, she came back to New York and contacted every one of his political colleagues, including Mayor Jimmy Walker. They reassured her everything was fine, but just to go back to Maine and they would find out what happened. However discreet their inquiries, they came up with nothing, and the girlfriend theory was tossed out, as it was feared he had been kidnapped or killed. When it came out, the story headlined in all the papers across the country, and police officially opened the investigation on September 3rd, 1930. This was almost 30 days after he was last seen. Crater was described as a meticulous dresser. He owned dozens of suits, being given to double-breasted dark blue or gray most of the time. He also favored the old-fashioned type of high-folded stiff collar in which the necktie fitted in a very slim knot. He wore his silver-gray hair parted in the middle. The teeth in both his upper and lower jaws was artificial. The state of his teeth were used in the future more than once to compare skeletal remains thought to be his and disproven because the skull that was found had its original teeth, unlike him. Police searched his safe deposit box, which was found to be empty. The Crater's maid had returned only after August 25th. The chauffeur and the maid were questioned by police. There was talk of dragging Great Pond at the head of Belgrade Lake, close to the Crater's cabin. The inference was unmistakable. There was suspicion that Crater had returned to Maine, and he died there, either by his own hand or someone else's. Hiram C. Todd was a special prosecutor in charge of the case. At the onset of the investigation, the police complained they had run into a wall surrounding details of the judge's life. They even couldn't find out the name of his physician. Their interest, of course, was to verify the judge had any problems with his health. The police said that Crater was described by his court attendant, Mara, as, quote, very blue and moody, end quote, on August 6th. However, he was the only person who saw the judge that day who said that. Initially, Stella refused to appear before a grand jury, which was investigating her husband's disappearance. She claimed she was suffering from a nervous breakdown. However, the police had several reports. She was riding around the country in a vehicle as late as September 3rd, while her husband was being searched for. Later, she said in reference to her husband's fate, it was because of a sinister something that was connected with politics. She also said she had been advised by his colleagues to lay low and just go back to Maine. 4 months after Crater's disappearance, Stella told police she found three envelopes inside a drawer in their apartment at 40 Fifth Avenue. Inside them was $6,690 in cash and four life insurance policies totaling $30,000. His last will left everything to Stella. Several checks and stock dividends payable to Joseph Crater, bank passbooks, and a list of people who owed him money was part of the trove. Police thought it was strange since the apartment had been thoroughly searched already. Stella said the drawer was small and easily overlooked, especially with a bureau scarf that covered it. There was no proof, but this event seemed to indicate that someone had gone back into the apartment after October when it was last searched and placed the items there. Question was, who did it? Crater? A friend? Or his killer who had nothing against his widow? Without her husband's support, eventually she was evicted from their apartment on 45th Avenue. She went to work as a secretary. It wasn't until 1939 that she received $20,561, equivalent to almost $500,000 present day. This was from his life insurance, but that happened only once he was declared legally dead. Theories for the disappearance were attributed to amnesia, suicide, a new life with a showgirl, assassination because he knew too much about the corruption at Tammany Hall, that he died in the arms of a prostitute, and a blackmailer killed him after not being paid off. An Albany professor believed the judge was killed by gangster Jags Legs Diamond in the basement of an upstate brewery. Diamond, who was known for kidnapping people and hijacking bootleggers' shipments, was killed in December 1931. Besides the outlandish theories about his disappearance, there were more probable ones. Hot on the heels of his appointment, the New York Supreme Court was delving into claims of corruption of the Democratic Party and Tammany Hall, bribery, improper transactions, misuse of taxpayer monies, and selling of high-placed municipal jobs were some of the crimes being investigated. Crater himself was under investigation because in 1929, he was appointed as receivership of the foreclosed Liberty Hotel in the Lower East Side. He sold the hotel to the American Mortgage Loan Company for $75,000. 6 months later, the company sold it back to the city for $2.85 million. It led to suspicions that he had paid off Tammany Hall for his appointment to the New York Supreme Court. He denied all the allegations, and Samuel C. Berry, the chief counsel of the investigating committee, never found evidence to prosecute him on. The C. Berry investigation led to the resignation eventually of Mayor Jimmy Walker. The initial alarm and disbelief that a Supreme Court judge could disappear so mysteriously gave way in some instances to humor. Comedians of the day used the event for their skits, commenting, "Judge Crater, call your office." Since Lassie could find Timmy in the well, Mad Magazine portrayed her finding the judge. After Judge Crater's disappearance, many of his girlfriends left New York City. Constance Connie Bramer Marcus, the clothing model, who was Crater's mistress for 7 years, was questioned by the grand jury. She had been living at the Mayflower Hotel, where Crater came to see her once a week. He would send her $90 per month to pay her bills. She knew he was married. Connie met Crater when she was trying to divorce her husband, Louis Marcus, a salesman who had been sentenced to 3 years in Atlanta in connection to a bankruptcy case. He had said he would come to see her the day he disappeared. However, he never made the assignation. Connie Marcus was by no means sitting in a room waiting for a visit from Joe Crater. In 1928 and 1929, she was visiting Havana, Cuba. In late September 1930, Sally Lou Ritz, who was one of the last two people to have seen Judge Crater, was missing. She was appearing in the show Artists and Models in Chicago. Supposedly, her mother said that she was in Pittsburgh. Elaine Dawn, the chorus girl at the Club Abbey, disappeared as well. She surfaced at the Polyclinic Hospital and denied that she could help police search for Crater. She told authorities, quote, "In my position as a hostess and entertainer, I meet many men. I do not recall Mr. Crater." End quote. She said she was being treated for rheumatism. She was hospitalized for more than a year. June Bryce, another good time girl, was committed to an insane asylum. By the end of 1930, authorities were sending out subpoenas for any witnesses that could produce a lead to the case. The books for the Hotel Plymouth at 143 West 49th Street, Manhattan, were being looked at since there was a registration for Judge Crater and Sally Ritz in August at the hotel. According to the hotel manager, Sally Ritz and her mother have frequently been guests at the hotel. Samuel Buechler, a lawyer, told the DA that on the day before Crater's disappearance, a tall blonde woman, who gave her name as Lorraine Fay, appeared in his office to consult him about filing a break of promise suit for $100,000 against the judge. The authorities could never find this so-called mystery woman, and they later believed it was Connie Marcus in disguise who came to see Samuel Buechler. Emil K. Ellis, Mrs. Crater's attorney, had his own theory regarding the disappearance. He believed that on the night of August 6th, the judge went to the apartment of a showgirl who was blackmailing him. He tried to pay her with the $5,100 he had withdrawn, but she wanted more. She had male friends present, and there was a fight where Crater was hit on the head and killed accidentally. A false death certificate was obtained, and the judge was cremated in New Jersey. The showgirl later died in a mental institution. However, no evidence ever surfaced to confirm this theory. Later was believed the blackmailer was a notorious showgirl named Vivian Gordon, or in some cases, it might have even been another showgirl named June Bryce. Vivian mysteriously met with a grisly end 6 months after Judge Crater disappeared. Of all the women he was involved with, this was the only one that met a very horrible death within less than half a year after he had gone missing. Now, sightings of Judge Crater were reported everywhere, doing the oddest things, ranging from gold prospecting with a burro in California to acting as a shepherd out in the Pacific Northwest. A patient in a Missouri asylum was thought to be him. He was seen working on a steamer in the Adriatic, shooting craps in Atlanta, and having abandoned a career as a judge, he now ran a bingo game in North Africa. 6 years after Crater's disappearance, a man named Lucky Blackiette told one weird tale to officers at the LAPD. It happened while he was prospecting near Julian, California. His only company was his burro, until one day he crossed paths with who later turned out to be Good Time Joe, pulling along a loaded pack mule. They swapped yarns, and the man gave his name and said, "In one more year, I will be legally dead. I hope I can stick it out that long." Captain Allen with the Missing Persons Bureau did not dismiss the prospector's story and said, "5 years ago, we had a tip about Crater being at National City, and that information tends to correspond with what Blackiette has told us." Two officers with LAPD, two with NYPD, and a detective from San Diego County Sheriff's Office, and of course reporters, hightailed it out to the area between Warner Hot Springs and Julian. Even a plane flew overhead in the search. No sign of Crater, but they did find people who described seeing a man fitting his description. One, Mike Morani, even prospected with him for several months near Julian. He commented, "He was well-educated, but a poor miner." Owners of a grocery store recognized this picture and said he made a $5 purchase. When the temperature soared to 110 degrees, the enthusiasm of the searchers dwindled. A year later, they returned after another sighting. This time, the source was the wife of the San Diego County Sheriff's deputy who was part of the earlier search. She owned a small cafe and said Crater had been there 6 weeks earlier. Lucky Blackiette, whose real name was Maurice S. Condery, died in 1942 at the age of 61. He never came across Judge Crater again as he prospected throughout California. In 1938, Stella Crater secretly married an electrical engineer named Carl Kuntz. He was a German citizen. She made the papers again when a month after their marriage, her husband was involved in an automobile accident on the Henry Hudson Parkway. Dr. A.J. Raggi, head surgeon at St. Vincent's Hospital, and Samuel Edmonds, a dean at Pratt Institute, were killed. They were passengers in his car. This was the same Dr. Raggi who hosted a bridge party that Crater attended the day before his disappearance. One must wonder what would be the odds on that. In July 1938, Kuntz was arraigned on homicide charges. It was at this point that the marriage to Stella Crater became known. 8 days before they wed, Kuntz's first wife, Anna, hanged herself. He only had a daughter named Helen with a deceased woman. It turned out that Kuntz had been drinking when he crashed into the light pole that killed his friends and seriously injured him. The couple traveled to Germany at the end of 1938, and nothing came of the charges against Carl Kuntz. The couple lived in Maine once they returned to the United States. The marriage lasted 12 years. And like her previous two marriages, there were no children. During the times when she was not married, Stella worked as a bookkeeper. In 1961, Stella Crater published her memoir titled The Empty Robe, but it revealed nothing new. She died in 1969 at the age of 75. Stella visited a bar in Greenwich Village every year on August 6th in remembrance of her husband. She did this for the rest of her life. Crater was declared legally dead in 1939, and Missing Persons Report Case 13995 was closed officially in 1979. Every time an unidentified body of a man was found, it was speculated that finally Judge Crater had been found. Then another angle surfaced in 1954. Peter Golomboski, a retired New York detective, got a call from Henry Krause, a dying Harlem butcher, which he had known on the beat for about 25 years. Krause wanted to speak to him to get something off his chest. Golomboski recalled, "He wouldn't let me take notes and said that if his wife came in while they were talking, he would change the subject. He also said that if I ever told anyone about the conversation while he was alive, he would deny everything. I then told Krause to talk slowly so that what he said would sink in." Krause said that in 1930, he owned a house in Westchester County at 915 Palmer Road in Bronxville, which he often lent to political friends as a place where they could take their girlfriends. One of these was Judge Crater. He said that on August 10th, he went to the house and found it full of blood and booze and figured something terrible had happened there. Krause went on to describe how he washed down the blood with towels and left. He said that, quote, "Crater is buried up there," end quote. Mrs. Krause arrived and the conversation ended with a promise to speak further the following week. But this never happened since Krause who was suffering from terminal cancer, was stricken down and he died in the hospital a few days later. Golombowski went back to his desk at the 25th Precinct and wrote up his conversation with Krauss. He submitted the report to the head of the Missing Persons Bureau, and he was given the okay to investigate. Later, Golombowski found out that Krauss had at one time dug a wine cellar beneath the house, and although the basement contained a poured concrete floor, the wine cellar had a dirt floor. Before the Krauss family sold the house, concrete had been poured on the wine cellar floor. In 1976, Stanley Hooper, who then owned the house at 915 Palmer Road, confirmed the wine cellar was cemented. In 1955, Murray Bloom, a writer, went to Holland and showed the judge's photograph to Gerard Croisset, a Dutch medium. The psychic had helped police in Amsterdam and other cities to solve tough cases. He said that Crater had been kidnapped by hired killers due to a double cross, in which he was supposed to throw a case. He said Crater was killed at a Dutch-style farmhouse just 4 or 5 miles outside the city limits. He said the kidnapping took place in Manhattan and the crime was committed in Westchester County. John Cronin, an NYPD investigator, said the description fit information received from, quote, a shady German butcher who'd made a dying confession that his friends had buried Crater just outside of city limits, end quote. The butcher he referred to, of course, was Harry Krauss, who had died the year before. A Yonkers backyard was dug up with nothing to show for it. This was after paying the owner of the property $1,000 for the privilege. Only an abandoned road surfaced. Krauss's deathbed confession was not the only one which involved Judge Crater. In 2005, Stella Ferrucci Good died on April 2nd, age 91, and she left what might be an answer to what happened to Good Time Joe Crater. The clue was a handwritten letter in an envelope marked, "Do not open until my death." Her granddaughter, Barbara O'Brien, found it in a metal box in Stella's home. The contents of the letter described where Stella learned from her husband, the late Robert Good, that over drinks with Charles Byrne, an NYPD officer, and his brother, a cabbie named Frank Burns, and other men, that they did away with Judge Crater and put him under the Coney Island Boardwalk in Brooklyn. Supposedly, Frank Burns had driven off with a judge, then stopped a few blocks over where they were joined by two accomplices. Once they arrived at Coney Island, two more men arrived. The contents of the box, which included yellowed clippings about Crater's disappearance, also included reference that Officer Burns was assigned to guard Abe Kid Twist Relly's, a Murder, Inc. murderer who fell to his death from a window in room 623 at the Half Moon Hotel in Coney Island. Relly's was known for killing his victims with an ice pick, which he would ram through their right ear into the brain. The judge's resting place was supposed to be under a boardwalk near West 8th Street in Coney Island, which is present-day the site of the New York Aquarium, once the Coney Island Aquarium, which opened in 1957. The most pressing question was not answered, which was the motive for the killing. Barbara O'Brien's father, William St. George, said the police told the family that 5 bodies were found when the Coney Island Aquarium was under construction. Official sources have not confirmed that bones were found at the aquarium site in the mid-1950s. However, there was an officer, Charles Burns, with the force from 1926 to 1946, who was assigned to the 60th Precinct in Coney Island. Stella's family could not recall her ever mentioning the case while she was alive. At that time, there was still a $5,000 reward offered for any answer as to what happened to Judge Crater. So far, it's never been paid to anyone. As to the other women in Crater's life, in 1941, Sally Lou Ritz, her real name was Sarah Ritzy, then 28 years old, which would have made her 17 when she was involved with Judge Crater, made the papers because it appeared she was married to 2 men at the same time. After Crater's disappearance, she married John J. Dewey, then a Long Island hotelier. The marriage didn't work, and she became Diane of the dance team Dario and Diane. She asked for divorce at Hidalgo, Mexico for this marriage in 1937. Then she met Clarence Gould, a New York broker who had once been an actor. They married in July of 1939, but within a year the marriage had soured, and she was asking for $200 per month in alimony. He fought the separation and asked for an annulment, saying he hadn't been aware of his wife's Mexican divorce, and that Sally was still Mrs. Dewey, which invalidated their marriage. Dewey, for his part, belonged to a bombing squadron in Honolulu, and said that the Mexican divorce was a mail-order decree, and both he and Sally were in New York State at the time it was granted. Sally Lou faded from the headlines. She remained living in California, married, and had children and grandchildren. Constance Marcus, despite her long-standing relationship with Crater, also faded from the headlines. Of all the women who surrounded Joe Crater, only one joined him in the hereafter, shortly after his disappearance. Her name was Vivian Gordon. She ran with the same rough crowd that many believe might have done away with the judge. In February 1931, Vivian Gordon, 39, whose real name was Benita Bischoff, née Franklin, was dead. The redhead had been strangled to death. She had an 8-foot knotted clothesline around her neck, and she was found at the bottom of an embankment in Van Cortlandt Park. It was believed she had been tossed from an automobile. Her body, once clothed in a black velvet designer dress from Paris, expensive silk underwear, sheer black stockings, and no shoes, lay unclaimed in the Fordham morgue. She was found murdered shortly before her scheduled appearance before the Seabury Appellate Court Division's inquiry into cases of police framing of women. Her death occurred after she had written a letter to Isidore Kressel, former chief counselor for the Vice Probe, offering to tell everything she knew. Vivian was the daughter of John W. Franklin, a Canadian, and a former warden of Joliet Penitentiary in Illinois, and Margaret Moorhead, who hailed from Ohio. Born in 1891, life was not easy for Benita. By 1900, she was an orphan, along with her sisters Lillian, 14, and Arnolda Marguerite, 11. They were inmates at St. Joseph's Orphan Asylum in Chicago. Neither of her sisters ever married. Arnolda lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Lillian was adopted by the Thurston family. She took their surname and lived in Detroit, Michigan. Vivian sought another type of life, and by the time she died, she'd been rubbing elbows with underworld figures for about 20 years. A week after Vivian's death, her daughter Benita committed suicide, supposedly over the shame of the life and death of her mother. She was found unconscious in a gas-filled kitchen by her stepmother. Vivian's former husband, John E.C. Bischoff, called her, quote, an alcoholic, a dope addict, blackmailer, and prostitute, end quote. They had divorced in 1925. He worked as a deputy marshal at the District of Columbia Reformatory in Virginia. He had gained custody of Benita after Vivian was sent to Bedford Reformatory on an immorality charge. Vivian contended she was framed. After her divorce, Vivian went from showgirl to top-shelf prostitute, who soon turned into a madam with her own brothel. It's unknown how many knew that she kept precise notes about the powerful men who came to her establishment and what they talked about and what was overheard. Whether it was Vivian's idea or orchestrated by the gangsters she hung out with, soon powerful political figures were being blackmailed with information she had garnered when they visited her place. There were acquaintances who warned her this was very dangerous. The newspapers described Gordon as an adventurous and high-grade racketeer. Police read her diaries and letters, linking her name with Rothstein, McManus, Vannie Higgins, and others. Vivian was the model thought to be implicated in blackmailing Judge Crater. Within 2 weeks of the murder, Lena Holsey, Vivian's Cuban maid, told police of a ride with Vivian and two men on the night she was killed. Within 24 hours of Benita Bischoff's suicide, Lena reported to police that she was attacked at the Mount Vernon restaurant by two men who threw a burning disinfectant in her face. She said both claimed to be policemen. One said, "We are New York police. We came to tell you that you won't have to testify before the grand jury in the Bronx today. It has been adjourned until tomorrow." Then one man threw the liquid in her face, which seared her chin and right eye. They ran off when she screamed for her husband. Pierre Franklin, Vivian's brother, was the one to identify his sister at the morgue. It was noted that when Vivian was buried on March 7th, only her brother Pierre and an unidentified woman who kept her face muffled in the collar of a long dark coat followed the hearse to Mount Hope Cemetery. There were no flowers or anyone else. A few days later, Pierre Franklin was taken to Bellevue Hospital for observation after he was overcome in his hotel room. After several days, he was released and returned to Montreal, stating, "The things they are saying about my sister cannot be true." Vivian Gordon's name was being paired with Arnold Rothstein, a gangster who himself was assassinated, and a $500,000 love racket. Amid the sensationalism of Judge Crater's disappearance, another New York judge, Amedeo A. Bertini, dropped dead in Palm Beach where he was on vacation. The 48-year-old had been a close friend of Judge Crater and had been cleared by the Seabury investigation. Other headlines read, "Three women as key figures in New York vice probe." This, of course, stemmed from the murder of Vivian Gordon. One of the women was, quote, "a young Broadway girl, said to have been the last person who saw Judge Crater and then disappeared after the inquiry began." She was not named in the article. However, they were referring to Sally Lou Ritz, who did reappear, but made herself scarce when it came to New York and eventually moved to the West Coast. The other was a lady judge named Jean Norris, who was known for wielding a despot's hand over her court and with doctoring records. The New York investigation was originally authorized by Governor Roosevelt, but it was not intended to be a vice probe. The hearings turned into vice investigation by accident. One of the chief complaints against the magistrate's courts hinged around cases involving the arrest of women by vice squad policemen and stool pigeons on charges of immorality. Women testified they had been arrested by policemen and sentenced in court on framed charges when they refused to pay bribes. Kressel then fell under the microscope when the defunct Bank of the United States, of which Kressel was a director, had lost millions of the depositors' money. He, along with other officials of the bank, were indicted by a grand jury. The autopsy report issued about Vivian Gordon estimate she was killed about 3 a.m. on February 26. She had eaten around 1 a.m. Her meal consisted of celery, onion, cabbage, sauerkraut, eggs, and raisin. She was known to have left her apartment at 157 East 36th Street, Manhattan, about 11:20 p.m. She had some alcohol in her brain, but not sufficient to overcome her. She was probably hit on the head first, then hit behind the right ear with a slug shot, which left her unconscious. Then she was strangled. Because of Gordon's connection to the Seabury inquiry, it was receiving special attention from law enforcement. The police departments involved had become hostile when the Pinkertons Detective Agency were brought into the case. The inference was unmistakable. It was thought that the police departments could not be trusted. Authorities were looking for Polly Adler, a notorious character of the White Light section and former intimate of Vivian Gordon. The belief was that she knew the motive for the strangling. Polly was a well-known tenderloin character who had been arrested 14 times for maintaining a brothel, but she was never convicted. It was reported she was either in Havana or Miami during the probe. In 1928, Assistant D.A. Bohan, who was investigating a stock fraud case, interviewed Vivian Gordon as a voluntary witness in a case in which Joseph Radlow, Samuel Cohen alias Chowderhead Harris, and Leo were indicted on charges of grand larceny. It came to light that Vivian Gordon was examined by the DA's office and a subpoena was issued for the records. Then unexpectedly, it was learned the records were missing from the District Attorney Crane's office. The newspapers blasted the story that the records of Vivian Gordon's statement 3 years before could not be located. The error was said to be due to the negligence of a clerk. The stenographer never transcribed it and no record could be found of the testimony. Vivian's motivation for testifying was not altruistic, but born out of self-interest as she was hoping for a deal in order to evade a long prison sentence for prostitution and running a whorehouse. On August 7, 1930, Vivian was arrested on a charge of attempting to extort $200 from Joseph P. Radlow, a writer for a newspaper. She was using the name E.X. Swindler. A few days later, she was arrested on a charge of attempted extortion on complaint of Radlow. It was thrown out by the grand jury, when Gordon told her of her business relations with a complainant. Then Vivian instituted a civil suit against Radlow, who was a cousin of John A. Radloff, a Brooklyn attorney. Radloff was Vivian's lawyer, one-time lover, and financial consultant. Radloff was being held as a material witness in the murder case based on an entry in Vivian's diary that read, quote, "I fear only John A. Radloff. He could get Cohen or some of his friends to dispose of me," end quote. This was one of several black books found in her apartment at 156 East 37th Street, Manhattan. Cohen at one time was Vivian's bouncer. Later on in the investigation, both men provided alibis for their whereabouts when she was killed. The implications were clear. Vivian Gordon had been killed because of what she knew. The police commissioner distributed circulars to enlist the aid of 20,000 taxicab drivers, asking if she had hired them on the night of her death. In April 1931, Harry Stein, a racketeer and burglar, was indicted in the Gordon murder. In 1921, he had gone to jail for attempting to strangle a woman. A ladies' tailor with a shop on Broadway confirmed that it was Harry Stein who brought in a coat for appraisal and alteration. This coat turned out to have been stripped from Vivian Gordon's body after she was thrown from the car. It was worth about $1,800. Also missing was her $600 wristwatch and a $1,200 diamond and emerald ring, all of which she had been wearing the evening she died. The altered coat was to go to Mrs. David Butterman, wife of one of the material witnesses held in connection with the murder. Butterman claimed he refused the offer from Stein. In June, Harry Stein and Samuel Greenberg went on trial for the murder of Vivian Gordon. On July 1, 1931, they were acquitted. In the midst of the Gordon murder investigation, there was a report that Judge Crater had been seen in Cuba. Supposedly, Connie Marcus, Crater's mistress, had sent a telegram to a country club owner in Connecticut about the sighting, and she was known to frequent Cuba. Harry Stein might have outrun the law and getting justice for Vivian Gordon, but she did get her day. In 1955, he was executed for the murder of a Reader's Digest messenger. Before his death, he swore he had no knowledge of Crater's disappearance. There have been reports that the judge was slain in Vivian's presence while resisting an extortion attempt. None of these mysteries were ever solved, neither Crater's disappearance or Gordon's murder. But it's inescapable they were linked, most probably by knowing too much about the same group of people who decided it was expedient to get rid of them. They just became two more sacrificed on the Great White Way.